Well, here we are at Oxenhope, at the end of the Keighley and Worth Valley Railway. We're firmly in Bronte country, just a couple of miles from Haworth, where the world-famous family of writers lived. We're actually in the carriage shed and workshop where teams of volunteers spend years restoring old and worn-out carriages to their former glory. With me is one of those volunteers, Eric Rawcliffe. And first, Eric, we're going to talk about the carriage here, which is just in the final stages of restoration. What is it?
It's a club carriage, a Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway club carriage. The club element being a group of travellers from the Fylde Coast who had businesses in Manchester, formed themselves into a club and approached the railway to get a coach for their exclusive use. The original coaches were small six-wheelers that were converted, and they were beyond economic repair by 1912, which is when this coach was built in Newton Heath in Manchester.
So this is the continuation of the club's activities, as it were. They had an older carriage, and this is a brand spanking new one in 1912.
That's correct, and it's gas-lit in 1912. And the newfangled electricity wasn't trusted at that time, so it wasn't until 1917 that this was converted to electricity.
Right, let's go back a bit before we get into the detail and inside the club carriage. Just explain what the Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway was, how that fitted into the bigger picture of railways at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century.
Well, it started actually as the Manchester and Leeds Railway. It would have been one of the first railways, even before the Liverpool and Manchester, had there been parliamentary approval. But there wasn't, so it didn't get the accolade of being the first. But from the early 1830s, it extended not only from Manchester to Leeds, but brought in all sorts of other branches. And so finally, in 1847, they resolved to call themselves the Lancashire and Yorkshire Railway to better represent the scope of the railway at that time.
And the nickname for it was the Lanky.
The Lanky, and it was also the business line because it was well tuned into business. It was one of the most intensively worked lines. It had more signal boxes per mile than any other railway at the time. A very, very intensive service in the business of moving people around. It transported also a huge amount of freight. So the cotton that was spun in Manchester, for example, would then be taken into North Lancashire and East Lancashire for weaving.
But here at Haworth and at Oxenhope and at Keighley, the Keighley and Worth Valley Railway, that wasn't actually a Lancashire and Yorkshire railway itself, though, was it?
It wasn't. This was a Midland line. We are simply based here as guests, in one sense, of the Keighley and Worth Valley Railway, but we work extremely well together. They provide us the covered accommodation and the ability to refurbish the carriages, and in return, they get the use of the stock.
And I think it's quite appropriate, actually, because I think that Branwell Bronte, who was the brother of the Bronte sisters, he actually worked on that Manchester and Leeds railway.
He worked on the Manchester
in the 1840s.
And Leeds. He did. Manchester and Leeds, yes.
Do you know where?
He was down in Calderdale, and I don't think he was a very good employee because I think he was sacked.
He was a booking clerk, I think.
He was a booking clerk, and there was some discrepancy with... too many times there were discrepancies. So I think his services were dispensed with.
Right, let's go up the shed here and have a little look inside this club carriage. Just describe this building that we're in at the moment.
Part of it is the original goods shed for Oxenhope Station, and it's since been extended with Heritage Lottery funding so that we've got accommodation for approximately six vehicles at a time. We will be working on them with welding skills, with metalworking, with woodworking skills, refurbishing them back into serviceable condition.
And you've got all the tools that you would need to do that. I can see in front of me a big vise, and we've got all kind of files here.
A lot of the equipment that you see has been donated from factories who have put more modern equipment in, and they've handed down to us their older equipment.
And do you need that old equipment? Do you need precise old equipment to actually do the restoration of the carriage?
In many instances, yes. It's amazing the number of techniques that were possible in the when this coach was built in 1912, for example, that we just can't replicate today. We've had great trouble recently trying to get some glass double beveled. On the corners of the glass, they were rounded, and actually beveling on both sides around those corners has proved impossible. So we've finished up having to have single panes and then laminate them.
Right, let's go up these little steps that you've got into the back of the carriage. It actually looks like a traditional railway carriage. It's not, as it were, a little tiny thing, is it?
Not at all. 58 foot long and 9 foot wide. It's the full loading gauge. You are in what the cricket club did.
Now the cricket club, how does that come into it?
Now, I should have told you that beforehand, shouldn't I? This was a body that was grounded at Derby. So instead of it being scrapped when it was out of service, the LMS cricket club decided this would make a superb pavilion for them.
And when you say grounded, they took off the wheels?
They took off all the underframe. So we were able to rescue it as a complete body, but without the underframe.
And it was their pavilion and for how long?
It was their pavilion for a good number of years, about 35, 40 years.
Right.
From the early 1950s up until the mid-90s. If you were a club member, you'd have been standing in the shower now. But obviously we've had to take those out and completely rebuild the end so that we've got a WC and a lavatory, the proper meaning of lavatory, the place where you wash.
A little sink which is actually triangular. It goes into the corner.
Goes into the corner.
Nice use of space.
And it is an original LMY sink. You can see the logo on it, the original LMY. So the first thing you do when you rescue it is you've got to find out what you've got and strip it all down. So it became a skeleton. And then you find out from that stripping what you've got to do to get it back to a decent condition.
Now, you're not far off finishing it now, are you? All the woodwork seems to be done. It seems to be spruced up. You've got a lot of glasswork in here. Can you just kind of describe it to me and some of the things that you've had to do to get it back into this original condition?
Well, as you might imagine, with it being a sports pavilion, everything had been painted white, many, many coats of it as well. And that, while it made it hard work to strip off, it has enabled us to get back to the original woodwork, which in here is mahogany, wonderful condition, being protected by these multiple layers. Very little damage can be done, because when this was a grounded body in the early 1950s, materials were in short supply. So any alterations that were made by the club, they used the original pieces of timber and just moved them into a different position. And that's enabled us, as we stripped it, to find the original things and put them back to where they should have been.
And is this varnish here?
No, this is polish in LMY terms, which is French polish. There was a strict instruction that no varnish should be used inside this vehicle. And we couldn't work out why that was until we realised that when you look around, if you see the window sills, in many instances you will see that cigarettes have been left to burn out on there. And if it was varnished, that would be quite difficult to repair in the short time that it was available, because this carriage had to work 6 days a week. However, if you French polished it, then you'd be able to, because that's extremely quick drying, the attendant who came with the vehicle would be able to conduct the repairs whilst it was parked up at Manchester, having delivered the businessmen in the morning and before he took them home again in the night.
It's got little, nice little brass luggage racks, which look to me to be a bit too tiny to take suitcases. So what were they used for?
Well, you wouldn't be. You're talking here about businessmen who would be carrying briefcases and umbrellas. They certainly wouldn't be carrying suitcases. So nobody would be going on holiday in this. It's strictly a working vehicle.
Tell me a little bit more about those businessmen. Who were they? Where did they live? And how did they come to form this club that had a carriage all to themselves?
They were businessmen with all sorts of interests in Manchester, but they lived out on the Fylde coast. So the Fylde coast comes from Blackpool and round the Ribble estuary into Lytham, St Anne's. And they were travelling as first-class season ticket holders, what they called contracts in those days, into their businesses in Manchester each day, 6 days a week, because they worked a 5.5-day working week. And they obviously were having to fight with all the other first-class passengers to get a seat. They decided that they would prefer, rather than have to fight for a seat, to have a specific seat. And ideally, so they could conduct their business between themselves, they could also have a carriage for their exclusive use.
Oh, I see. So deals were done on this carriage. It wasn't just
almost
commuting.
Certainly. Almost certainly. If you get any group of businessmen together, and I'm sure you'd see it on the East Coast Main Line today, travelling down to London, there would be business meetings in progress.
So they clubbed together and they got the railway to actually build a coach for them.
With a lot of negotiation, the railway weren't too keen to start with, but the negotiation with the railway culminated in there being the railway demanding a fee from them of 120 guineas per year for exclusive use. And they had to guarantee a minimum of 40 members.
And they each had an individual seat, you say?
Yes, you would have been hung had you sat in the wrong seat. And particularly the more senior members, who would be blackballing potential members, obviously, because they were an autonomous club, they would select which seat they wanted as well. And if you look at the two partitions that you can see, which divides the saloons, you'll see they are different shapes. Both originally were the same, but we do know that in 1920, one of them was extended. The reason for that, we are pretty sure, is because there was a very active card school and the more senior members were fed up with the card school being interrupted with the door opening in the middle, which they would have been with the original partition layout. So they prevailed upon the railway to have the partition extended so that the door no longer interrupted the card school.
What kind of games of cards did they play?
We don't know particularly. We do know they were gambling, because from relatives of people who were club members, one of them tells a story that literally one of the club members did get home with a shirt one time. He literally got the shirt off another person's back. And we are also told by that family member that he didn't half get into trouble from his wife. So even though the gentlemen of the club, because it was, of course, pre-emancipation, it would be gentlemen only, men only, they still got some trouble from their wives when they got home. Well, we've got three saloons, and they were laid out in a formation of 10, 16 and 14 as individual armchairs, and they go around the saloon.
I tell you, it's lovely sitting here in this plush leather armchair pretending to be a rich businessman. I'd love to be able to sort of ring a bell and get the steward to bring me a drink.
He would bring you a libation, one that would stimulate but not inebriate.
Oh, so I couldn't have a glass of wine or a whiskey?
You couldn't. One of the rules of the club was very much that it was strictly teetotal.
I'm surprised it was just teetotal. I thought rich businessmen, they'd like a drink.
I'm sure they would.
And especially going home in the evening.
And no doubt when they got home, they would enjoy that. But, of course, being a businessman's train, they would also want to have their wits about them when they were travelling, because not only could they conduct deals on the way into work, but from the knowledge that they gained in the business, they may well want to conduct them on the way home as well. So you'd need a clear head for that.
It sounds to me that as well as doing the actual work on the carriage, you get as much of a kick out of this from finding out what used to happen on a carriage like this.
Yeah, it's very much part of the social history of the UK, seeing what people did in those years. You know, what did my ancestors do? What did these businessmen do? You can imagine how they lived. They would have a coachman. Their coach would be arriving at some unearthly hour in the morning, 6:30, to take them to the station, to get onto the train to go to Manchester. Because realistically, that would be the only way they could travel that distance. The train was the only way you could do it in the sort of reasonable time. The roads at that time just would not have allowed you to do it. So that very much is part of the whole social fabric of the country. And I'm not sure that people appreciate just what the railways have done for the country. Not a political point, just a factual point.
Yeah, it's living history, isn't it?
It's very much living history. It's fascinating to get into the lives of these people. And that, as much as anything, stimulates you into completing this work so that you can get this vehicle running and people can see what it was like in those days, so that people can understand just how important it was that the railway provided the services to these businessmen and just how much they relied on the railway to conduct their lives.
I'm sitting now in what will probably be described as the height of luxury, or at least it was when it ran on the railways. I'm sitting in a Pullman carriage, and Pullman was a company that was easily recognisable on both sides of the Atlantic, because it was George Pullman who started the company way back in the 1860s. And his idea of first-class sleeping carriages was taken from America and brought to the British Railways. And with me here in this carriage is Peter Eastham and Ken Roberts, who've been responsible for restoring it. So first, Peter, tell me how long it's taken you to actually bring it back to the luxury that we're sitting in at the moment.
Well, this carriage was in fairly derelict condition. We started work on it about 7 years ago. The coach itself was built in 1930 and was one of two built specifically new for the Bournemouth Bell luxury service, which ran from London Waterloo to Bournemouth. The amount of steelwork was quite considerable. New pressings had to be made. There was a lot of corrosion, particularly ends of the vehicle and under the windows where rain had penetrated. And so that was quite extensive. Some framework underneath and heavy plating had to be re-riveted on and so on.
Looking around you now, what you do see are the seats and the upholstery. Now, this upholstery, I do understand, was very similar or identical to the Pullmans of the time, of the early 1930s. You don't see the beauty of it until you get into daylight.
No, we're actually sitting in the dark in the carriage here, aren't we?
Yes, exactly. And the marquetry in both this vehicle and the next vehicle are identical.
And this marquetry, that's very, very precise woodwork that's done.
It is, yeah. Luckily, that wasn't damaged too much. We do hope the people who ride in it enjoy it.
What I like about these carriages, and that I can just about remember from my youth, is the outside colour. The fact that they're this brown and cream colour. And to me, that signifies a Pullman train, a first-class train, which in those days I could never afford to go on.
Yes, yeah, it was the height of luxury travel. The outside is quite decorative. I've done all the painting and the lining out is quite extensive. You know, when they are finished, they do look quite splendid.
And there isn't a sign of any plastic in this, is there, Ken?
There might be, if you're, I'll tell you where it is, but nobody can see it. Seeing as roll plugs and things like that, you know. Plastic, as you may think or describe, no.
Were they more expensive to travel in than ordinary first class carriages?
Yes, they all. You booked your ticket and you did have to pay a supplement. I do recall one fella telling me he went from London Waterloo to Bournemouth, second class Pullman, had to pay a half crown, 2 and 6 penny supplement for riding in the Pullman each.
I tell you what, it's actually like being on the set of the Antiques Roadshow sitting here.
Yes, it's all exotic woods, polished brass and luxury. I think one of the big contrasts, again, compared with modern trains, is the amount of leg room and general space that's available. Modern trains tend to have aircraft-type seats and not much leg room and so on. So I think the comfort is a big thing. And the service, of course, being served on at table and, you know, the quality of the meals and so on. I think it all goes down very well with the customers.
Well, we're outside the carriage shed now here at Oxenhope, and I'm standing in front of another carriage. This one actually looks to me as though it's finished its restoration, and it's standing in the yard here attached to a diesel shunting engine. With me is Chris Lawson, and it says owner on your badge, Chris, Saloon 21661. So what's this carriage here?
Well, this carriage is probably best known as the Old Gentleman's Saloon from the Railway Children film, because this is the vehicle that was actually used in the film by William Mervyn, who played the old gentleman, and was used by him to travel up and down the line, waving at the children and finding their father for them in the very end.
Right, so if you've seen the original Railway Children film, you can probably picture in your mind's eye what this carriage looks like. It's a teak finish, I think that is, and it's varnished on the outside, and it says LNER. Now, my train spotting history tells me that's the London and North Eastern Railway. So that's who it used to belong to, Chris?
Subsequently, yes. But originally, it was actually built in 1871 for the Stockton and Darlington Railway as a four-wheeled smoking saloon.
So that's very ancient. That goes back to people like George Stephenson.
Almost, yes. Not far short. In 1868, Parliament actually passed legislation which required the railway companies to provide smoking carriages on all their trains. Rather a different position to what we find ourselves in today.
And when you say smoking carriages, that's the separate carriages for people to smoke in.
Yes, because as today, people were arguing and very unhappy about being together, smokers and non-smokers. And Parliament said, OK, well, the smokers have got to have separate accommodation, and this vehicle was built as a four-wheel saloon to meet that legislative requirement. It was a third-class saloon. It had oil lamps in the roof and it had spittoons in the floor.
Good. Can we climb up the old little steps here and have a look inside?
Yes, indeed we can. You just hold on to the handrails as you come up. Walk through and down and into the saloon itself.
So what's that little compartment that we've just come through then, where the door is?
That's the steward's compartment. The steward on board this had also to act as the guard, so it's also the guard's compartment. And we've moved from, if you like, the staff end into the boss's end, the end where the locomotive superintendent would have been, because this turned into an officer's inspection saloon in the early 1880s.
Ah, so it went from being this smoking carriage for third-class passengers that you mentioned, it became a much grander saloon later in its life.
Indeed. In the early 1880s, the then locomotive superintendent on the North Eastern Railway, which had absorbed the Stockton and Darlington by then, said, I'm a very important person and I want my own inspection saloon, please, and I want this one.
So this was just for one bloke?
Yes. Oh, yes.
But he was the top bloke?
But he was the top bloke. This became his inspection saloon, and it was put onto six wheels. And in 1904, Wilson Worsdall had become the locomotive superintendent on the railway, and he decided he was even grander. And he, to start with, he wanted to be called the chief mechanical engineer rather than the locomotive superintendent. And he said, and I want a rather grander vehicle to go with my new title. And he therefore had it extended by about 10 feet behind us, and put onto the bogies. So we're now in the 1904 configuration.
And how did it end up here on the Keighley line? Had it been a cricket pavilion like that other one we've been in?
No, it hadn't. This is, if you like, the other end of the story. It continued in use as an inspection saloon for various people in various parts of the northeast of England, and it ended up in York in the 1960s as the inspection saloon for the signal and telegraph engineer.
When you say inspection, what does that mean?
That means that he would travel out in this to inspect the premises that he was responsible for. The locomotive superintendent was responsible for the construction, design, running of locomotives, carriages, wagons, so he'd visit depots, sheds and anything else.
It sounds very much like as though the top railway officials were rather like military generals doing all this inspection.
You could say that. Today's comparison, I suppose, is with the supermarket chiefs who go out and visit their stores unannounced. It's the same sort of principle, to see what's going on the ground, get the feedback, but make sure that everything is being done in accordance with what they have laid down. And the seniority, the importance of the locomotive superintendent can't be overemphasized. He really was the top man on the railway.
The Lancashire and Yorkshire carriage was a teetotal, I understand, but you've got a whiskey decanter here in this carriage. So the railway people who went in this, they liked a bit of a tipple when they were on board, did they?
Well, even better than that, because in the steward's compartment, there's a wine rack as well. When the chief mechanical engineer had finished his inspection and had everybody in the saloon and had a meeting with them, as they went off to do their business and put things right that he found were wrong, he would retire to the settee at the end here, and doubtless the steward would bring him a glass of wine to soothe the fevered brow, because he'd have had a pretty strenuous day, you'll understand.
What I like about these carriages is they're not actually museum pieces. You can actually get inside them and use them in the way that they were originally used.
That's actually the key thing. From my point of view, it's important that people have the opportunity to experience what it was actually like to travel in a vehicle like this and see how the senior officers of the railway used to go about their business. So to have people on board sitting here, having a cream tea, enjoying the view, is fantastic. That they get the direct experience of what it was like in a way which you can't get from all the talk, all the films that you might see and everything else. Actually being on board is the key thing.
It's rather like the private jet of railway travel, isn't it?
Yes. We've had a lot of people on board who said, can we borrow this to use for our daily commute? Because this is a rather superior way of travel.